I'm David Flaherty, Marketing Director for Washington Wine. This is Sommelight. Sommelight is a conversation series where we talk to some of our favorite wine pros from around the country, talk a little bit about shop, but more importantly, find out what makes them human and what makes them tick. I'm super excited to welcome to the show today, Eugenio Jardim. A native of Brazil, Eugenio moved to San Francisco in 1988, where he worked at several top restaurants in the city and soon fell into wine. In 1995, he co-created one of the most cutting-edge wine programs in the country, when EOS Restaurant and Wine Bar opened. And from 2001 to 2013, a whopping 12 years, he held the wine director position at Jardinière, one of San Francisco's most iconic restaurants. In 2010, Eugenio was named Sommelier of the Year from Sunset Magazine. He's taught classes through the University of Berkeley, Culinary Institute of America, and has helped establish many critically acclaimed restaurant wine programs. He's been the U.S. Ambassador for the Wines of Portugal since 2015, and is the acting director of wine studies at the San Francisco Cooking School. Eugenio, it's amazing to see you. First of all, how are you and where are you?
Hey, David, I'm well. How are you? I'm in San Francisco enjoying a very rainy day, which is rare for us these days, not for you.
Well, yes, we got you matched on the rain today, my friend. It's really all about those like half an hour rain breaks.
Very welcoming rain.
Well, it's great to see you. I know that you're a tennis fan, so I want to start by saying, let's pretend that Halloween is approaching. As a tennis fan, which of the following three costumes would you choose to wear to a party? This is option number one.
McEnroe.
That is the McEnroe. It even says, you can't be serious on his shirt.
Awesome.
All right. This is number two.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah, not very flattering. And then, this is number three. And just to zoom in a little bit, it appears to be a head wound from a tennis ball.
I think I'm going to go classic McEnroe.
McEnroe
is a classic. Number one.
There's only one answer, man.
Love that man.
All right. Well, you spent more than 25 years on the restaurant floor. And that is nearly unheard of. What kept you coming back day after day, night after night?
Oh, boy. That is one interesting and loaded question, because I could be very sappy and say, oh, the love for wine, the love for the customers. It's none of that. It's just a drive to excel. It's almost like you have two options when you're in the restaurant business. Either you own the restaurant and you put your heart and soul into that because that's yours, or you own the wine program and you have a constant uninterrupted relationship with that program, in a sense that you just want to kill it night after night. You want to, like, what's the newest thing? What's the most exciting thing? How am I going to face this evening? And I guess I was a sucker for it. I loved it. I loved working the floor, and I have no regrets for my years as a sommelier.
That's funny. Like, what is it about the life, the profession of the sommelier that you feel is most misunderstood?
I think there are a couple of things that are very misunderstood. One is the glamorized vision of it, that we sit around all day long drinking Burgundy, guilty, that we sit around all day long drinking wine and having fun. And then we walk on the floor wearing Armani suits and never drop one drop of sweat. That couldn't be further from the truth. Before you walk into the restaurant, before the doors open, there's so much work that goes behind the scene. There's such a crunch time to get things done for when the customers walk in, everything looks beautiful, including your appearance. I mean, an hour, if you get to a restaurant, as you know, David, an hour or two before it opens, the sommelier is actually jacket off, tie off, and is slapping boxes of wine, stocking shelves, stocking fridge, shouting at bartenders and sommeliers, and what do we need and what we are short on, and et cetera. So I think the physical aspect of the work is very underestimated. And the second, instead of the physical, is the fiscal, because it's on my shoulders, the profitability of the program. The more profitable the program is, the better the restaurant does, the more money everyone involved makes, and the more sustainable my program is. The rotation on inventory is always in the back of your head. When you walk up to a table, you're always thinking, okay, my focus today is to sell a lot of champagne. I'm a little heavy on champagne, or I have a lot of Washington Cabernet Sauvignons because I love them. So, but I need to sell this vintage because I need to make room for the next vintage. So even though we walk around looking like we're just parading around, there are a lot of thoughts going through our heads throughout in the run of one shift.
I feel like the buzzword of today, of any restaurant professional, a lot of people that are now wineries running tasting rooms, everyone talks about the word hospitality. But you, of the many people I've met in this business, there is something innate for you just in the feel of talking to you, of being around you, of the way you present yourself. Like, what does that word mean to you? And then to follow up with that, when you meet somebody for the first time, be it on the restaurant floor or they're in the wine business and they are exuding what you would call hospitality, like, let's break that down. What does that mean for you personally? How do you approach that? And then how would you read that in somebody else and say that person embodies hospitality?
Oh, this is such a good question. Damn it. How much time do we have? I think it's a combination of warmth and sincerity. I think you really need to mean it when you are being hospitable, because I think that I'm a good reader of people. And if I find that the sincerity, that they lack sincerity on the approach, or that it's a more calculated approach than a natural, because you've seen, it's always people that smile, and then as soon as they turn away, their smile dies. I mean, when I smile, I go smiling all the way to the end of the hall because I'm still in that feeling.
Right.
In the early 90s, I was working in a restaurant in downtown San Francisco. It's a restaurant that later turned into a nightclub. So there's that moment of a nightmare when you're trying to finish your fine dining tables and all the late night cool and hip and gorgeous people of the city are arriving. And there's that chaos. So one night there was a cocktail waitress that was late and the general manager was panicking. And I said, "Don't worry, I will take the first round," which means the room was going to fill out with people ordering bottles of champagne, bottles of wine, cocktails, beers, waters. And I handled about, I think, 10 to 15 tables until the cocktail waitress that was late could catch up and all of that. And in that period, I made a lot of money. So when I met my friends at the bar and they go, "So," like mocking me, "How was that nightmare? Why did you make $2? I was like, "No, actually, kind of a couple hundred dollars." And their jaws just dropped, like, "In a half an hour?" And I was like, "Yeah." And then one of them said to me something I'll never forget. "Eugenio, you make more money than anybody here. You know why?" I was like, I was going to say, "Because I'm better." But she said, "Because you give a damn. You give a shit. You actually care that experience be a fulfilling experience." So hospitality to me is, it's not like a person that is throwing a party at their house, but really hated to be doing that and can't wait for the guests to leave. And the difference between that and a person that loves to welcome people and instead of greeting you at the door, tell, "Come to the kitchen, I'm cooking." And the party is in the kitchen around the fire.
Okay, here's a question for you. I used to work for an owner of a restaurant that told us as managers doing the hiring, we would sort of do the initial vetting of people in the interview. And if somebody was great or we thought they were good, they would kind of pass on to then meet the owner. And he told us, I remember a couple things about this. He said, a great server or a great person on the floor, it's two skills working at once. It's hospitality and it's service. And service can be taught. Service is a very step-by-step.
Bingo.
Steps of service. Here's where you clear the fork. Here's where the knife goes. You can teach them that. He was under the belief, and this is a gentleman that grew up in the restaurant industry. His family was restaurateurs, that hospitality could not be taught. You either have it or you don't. And it was our job to kind of suss that out in the way that they had eye contact or warmth or whatever it was you were looking for. Do you feel that that's the case? Can you teach somebody hospitality?
I kind of tend to agree with your old manager because I've always thought that je ne sais quoi that you must have to be successful in our business, that cannot be taught. Hmm. But I do believe that all the run of the mill, all the writing of tickets, all the selling, all the upselling, all the coordinations, all the, let me put together this tasty menu for you. All of those mechanic things are completely doable. But I don't think a warm personality is something you can learn. You either have it or you don't. There are people that you meet and you want to like, oh my God, don't go away. Let's go to the bar and get a drink. I want to talk to you all night.
Right.
And there are others that you politely goes, nice to meet you, and part ways. And that is almost natural. Your body responds to it. It's not really forced. So I believe in feeling, in having a quote unquote, a gut feeling for people when I meet them.
Do you feel that for you, it's a limitless well, that like that energy just keeps coming? Or do you hit a wall at a certain point and that sense of warmth, hospitality, you're empty and you got to go back and somehow refocus your mind, or, you know, tell yourself a couple of like mantras to get yourself back in the game? Did you find that in your time on the floor? Obviously that you're human, right? So that's going to happen occasionally, if not, you know, normally, but like for you, how did you navigate that?
David, I think it's very important not to have just one love in your life. I think it's very important that you are passionate about other things. For example, right before I went to work at Jardiniere, for those 12 years that I was the wine director there, I've played tennis almost two or three times a week before going to work. I got my exercise. I felt good about myself. I either felt really bad about my game or felt really good about my game. No matter, I felt good about playing. And then when that was all said and done at the end of the week, I want to surround myself with beauty. I've always thought that home has to be a sacred place where you go and you just shed all the plays, all the games you play, all the faces you make, all the smiles you didn't mean to give, but you had to. It wears you out. So you need to go home or somewhere beautiful and recharge. And to me, that was essential. I've always liked, and it's very, here's the tricky part. If you're in a relationship with someone that is not in the restaurant business, that can be very difficult because Friday night comes, they are ready to go. Friday night comes, you are working your behind off. And then Saturday comes, and if you're lucky not to work Saturday, you are exhausted. You need to just a home-cooked meal and stay home. And your partner is ready to hit the road and the world and the bars and the restaurants and the parties. So that can be a little tricky. So I think recharging is very important physically and emotionally when you work the floor. Because the last thing you wanted is to walk into a place and see a cranky face coming to greet you. You want to be the smile that maybe that person hasn't seen all day. And they're like, oh my God, you are a ray of sunshine. And how many times have you heard that? And how wonderful it is to hear that. You're the best thing that happened to me today. I had a terrible day of work, but now I'm here. I'm drinking this wine that you recommended. The food is great. Everybody's beautiful. Thank you. I heard that a million times, and it's my favorite thing to hear.
Yeah. I mean, there is something to like forcing the smile, but the reaction you get from the smile recharges the smile.
Yeah. Yeah.
You helped the team at Jardiniere earn a 4-star rating for service from the San Francisco Chronicle, which is a very big deal. Talk to us about leadership. How do you approach leading by example versus approaching each individual on the team to help bring up their game?
That is such an interesting thing because I remember the evening. I remember the day. I'm one of those people that have that really strange memory that if you come up to me, David, and said, hey, you're Eugenia, right? I met you one night at Jardiniere. And my wife and I finish your sentence. You're going to the opera. It was La Boheme. And it was the first time you want to see it. And you guys sat on table 72. And you wanted a white wine. She wanted red. So I got those two half bottles. Remember that? What was that half bottle again? But I remember situations like a picture perfect situation. And I remember that evening when the Chronicle critic was in and telling everyone around my table, like, remember what this business is called? And they go, restaurant business? food and wine business? I was like, no, service and hospitality. We're going to serve and we're going to be hospitable. And then I remember talking to them like, no sudden movements, no yanking anything out of anywhere. If you don't interrupt a conversation while you remove a dirty plate and you place a new glass, you accomplish your mission. Your mission is to be invisible in your efficiency. You want to be there when, if that person needs something, it turns, you are there. But if they don't, you are not there. I guess I've kind of talked to people. I chose the server that I wanted to work with me that evening because I wanted to surround. And also, David, something very important also that I said to the team every single time that we had somebody very important coming to dinner, and I know Chef Tracy would be pleased that they had a good experience. I used to talk to the hostess also and kind of map out who's going to be seated around that table. I used to tell the waiters, like, be as attentive as you are to this table and that table as you are to them, so they don't feel that they are getting a preferential treatment, that you are that excellent with all.
As a leader, when do you know? Because I think that that's often what people don't realize about a restaurant. And I have not been to Jardiniere, but I'd imagine that you being there for 12 years, when you were on the floor with young servers or young sommeliers, they were watching you constantly. You were probably having conversations with them a lot. You know, here's what we need to focus on. Here's what I saw back there, blah, 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 blah. When do you know that you've made a difference with somebody, a team member that you're trying to mentor or help along to get better at their craft? Like, when do you know that it's working? And then how do you adjust or not with a difficult team member where you just kind of can't seem to crack? What do you do? How do you handle that?
Well, there are several situations within this one. One of my favorite things to do when somebody's starting to work with me is that I would pull them into my station, which is like a semicircle that oversees the entire room. And I used to say to a person, what do you see? And they go, oh my God, these people are going to be freaking out. There's so many people coming in at once. We're going to be so busy and this and that. Okay, but now let's look at the tables. What do you see? And I would like, and they look a little puzzled. These are like people that I've invested on. I would say first date, they're both a little nervous. So we need to break the ice with kindness, with big smiles, but give them space. Don't make them feel awkward about anything. If they don't know what sweet breads are, don't explain kindly. If they call Merlot Merlot, just respond Merlot. Don't go there. That table there, power money. Those have expense account. Look at them. They're all like trying to measure who's the biggest guy on the table, and they want to go big. So you want to be as enthusiastic with their enthusiasm or of having a big night out as they are having. Now that is a lovely family. Look at like how they brought the kids. It may be, you know, a middle school graduation or something important or a birthday. So be extra sweet, pay attention to the children. Don't talk to the adults in the front of the children like they're not sitting there. We address them. And so I go table to table and I would say to them how I would read that room. And then how I know I accomplished a mission is that same waiter came back to me a couple of days later. He said, Eugenio, remember our reading of the room? Is that, yeah. There's a table I can't read. I cannot tell what those people are. And I feel a little bit nervous because they're very aggressive. So that person came to me to handle that situation, and I did. So that was an accomplishment to me, that I showed them the universe of a restaurant. That is not like people that you're just going to plop a plate down, a glass down, and eat and drink and go. That's not it. You have no idea why people are there that day. And it's your job to indiscriminately make them all have the time of their lives or have whatever they expected from that evening to transpire. It's your obligation. That's why you're in the service and hospitality industry.
It's listening, paying attention, responding, yeah. Being yes. Flexible, reacting to the moment. You've learned a ton about people through your time in restaurants. on a basic level in a restaurant, but also in life, what's the quickest way to make a guest or a new person relax around you and let you take them on a journey?
I have two very interesting situations, and they're very contrasting situations. One was one time, this is not a jardiniere, at a different restaurant, a guest was holding his girlfriend's hand. She was behind him, and we were walking on us on a narrower path. And he had $100 on his hand like this, pointing to, because I kept walking and saying, this direction, this. Then I noticed $100 in his hand, and he pushed it to me and said, pretend that I'm a regular and that you know my name is John. So I was like, John, I have your favorite. You have to react quickly. Yeah. So I was like, John, your favorite table. I hope you're okay sitting here again. I think you told me last time that you liked this table. So I made it up that little theater for that person to feel that he was welcome. Mm-hmm. The opposite situation was a very aggressive table saying that, slamming the wine list down and goes, I don't know any wines on this list. What am I supposed to drink if I don't know anything? I was like, think about this. You're going to have something new tonight. Tonight's going to be a new experience where you're going to discover something that you may fall in love with. So it's about turning a negative to a positive. Like, I don't know anything on this list. How am I supposed to enjoy this? To like, oh, look at the bright side. You're going to try something new today. And who would say to you, oh, no, I don't want anything new. I want to be stuck in there in the rut.
There's something about taking charge of that moment, right? Not in a way that's authoritative or like pushing them out.
Yeah.
But it's kind of like giving them a confidence that you're a professional and you know what you're doing. You know, that's a fine line though, right? Because David, people are reading you quickly too. And some people might not be good at reading you and be like, this guy just came on way too strong. But there is something about that authority at the table that people have to learn to have. And I think that applies to life too.
I had a friend that worked with me. She was a lawyer and she was an attorney. She had just passed the bar or was studying for the bar. And I was like, this is the best place you could be. Look at how many jurors are here. Read them. Learn how to read them. Check out every single one. But my favorite story, David, is that this very aggressive gentleman one day, the waiter comes desperate and said, Eugenio, I cannot handle that table. That's you. And they want to see you. And the guy is mad. I was like, mad? They just sat down. And I go to the table. He slams the wine list down and says, you call this an award-winning wine program? And I said, I don't. The critics did. And then he goes, well, and then he flips pages. You have none of the Parker Top 100 wines or Wine Spectator Top 100, or you don't have any Parker 100 points wines. And I said, sir, the selections on that list were made by me. I am here and I can explain to you why I made every single choice on that list, because that's very personal to me. Mm-hmm. Now, imagine if I peppered this list with 100 point wines from Parker and you buy one and you hated it. I can't get Parker on the phone to explain to you why he gave 100 points to that wine. But if you pick one of my 100 points wine, I'm here.
Did that work?
It disarmed him completely. By the end of the night, we were hugging, taking pictures together, and exchanging business cards, and he became a regular.
Yeah, it's funny. Yeah. Like I think that thinking back on when I started working waiting tables, you know, you play with that every single table. You learn something. You learn something in the way you approached. Did that disarm and invite them? Did that shut some weird door that I spent the next two interactions trying to like crawl out of? It's really fascinating. Again, I think back to some of the best floor managers or waiters I've ever worked with. It's like, it's not aggressive hospitality, but it's, I guess it's confident. It's
confident.
It's beyond confident because it's something assertive about it. But it doesn't take away the guest's power. It's a really interesting line that you're...
And I also think that I go back to my first topic was sincerity. And if you approach with a sincere and honest desire that person has have a great time and a great experience, it kind of is transparent and is a little bit transcends that they're just eating food and drinking beverages. It becomes like a moment that it will be remembered. I heard from many people over and over again, thank you for guiding me through this. I got here, I was in such a bad mood. I had such a bad day at work. If you didn't walk me through this, I would probably have walked out and dissatisfied with the experience. So it was really lovely to hear.
That's a cool way to look at it. I love
that. That works, yeah.
That's good guidance, right? Like you're the guide. I mean, that puts you in a power position that like, I'm taking these guests on a journey. I'm the guide, I'm gonna follow, you know, tell them what to look and what to enjoy.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you, because you are very on the scene. You presented and been on many panels, great wine seminars around the country at some of the best festivals. But I just saw you a few weeks ago at Texom in Dallas. And it was a seminar called What is a Sommelier? And you guys were talking about the past of the sommelier profession, the future, et cetera. But you said something that like really kind of stuck with me. And I've been thinking a lot about, because I keep hearing it now, which you said, very simply, every day I work on my communication skills. And I thought, wow, what does that mean? Because you are a great communicator. But I heard this week too, somebody else say that. They said, you know, it doesn't matter what profession you're in. It doesn't matter what you studied in college or what you came from. For them, the most important skill of anybody that's successful that they determine was they're great communicators. So what is that to you? Why is communication something at your level in the career that you're still working on every day? Why is that important? Why does that have weight?
I guess it's the love of conversation. I appreciate a good conversation. I appreciate simple, easy chit chat. The small talk is torture to me. That's why I've approached every table that I was going to perhaps just sell two glasses of wine. But I approached them, I was having a conversation with them as opposed to chit-chat or quick talk on a party, for example. Small talk, it is so difficult for me. It is so difficult. I would end up like this. It doesn't come out. Like if it is something that I'm not interested or that I'm faking it, it's really difficult for me. So I think the reason to work on communication skills is because the world is changing so fast. Communication styles are changing so fast. As you've seen me talk, I am sometimes extremely filtered, sometimes totally unfiltered. And I let the bombs, whatever the bombs are, S or F, I let them come out because it's fitting to that moment, to that audience. So I'm always studying the audience and seeing, I throw a little nugget and see if they bite. And if they, it's like almost a comedian checking out, doing stand-up comedy. I guess I learned this because I have a theater background, but you throw a little nugget and if they bite, you go, oh, okay, next one is going to be a bigger one. And let's see how they react to that. And then you establish this like, oh, they're getting into it. They're in with me. They are here. I got them. I love really fine-tuning my delivery. Because David, you work for an institution and I work for an institution. Our message doesn't change. The facts, the data changes here and there, but the message remains the same. So how do you keep the message fresh? So that's why I say that every day I have to think about it. Okay, how do I present this picture with a different light? How can I add a twist here or there?
I love that. I mean, that's the actor, right, that does the Broadway play 1,115 performances.
And every performance is different.
Every performance is different. And you can do that with wine education.
Yeah.
You can do that in speaking about the wines of Washington for people that are new. You can tailor that talk to people at different levels. I mean, that's what we do in the wine business. It's like nobody wants you to come to their table or to their presentation or to their cooking class where you teach about wine. And you just dump everything on the table that you know. I mean, that's an entirely selfish thing to do that doesn't further any discussion.
Yeah. And I also think that it is, I think you can only do what we do after you've been through a lot in your career, because there is a comfort in your own skin, but also a confidence that comes from your accomplishments. But also there's something about it that it is charming and disarming if you don't make it about you. The audience will respond to that. The students will respond to that. The customers will respond to that. If they think I'm in the presence of royalty, and that royalty says, how can I serve you? That is disarming and charming. And I always choose that route. I don't want it to be about me and look at me, look at me, look at how much I know, look at what I've done, look at where I've gone, look at what I'm drinking. And you have to take yourself out of that equation and remember service and hospitality.
You had a long run in restaurants. Let's move past that, because you've done something that a lot of people that work in restaurants want to do. They don't know how to do. They don't know if they can do that, which is transition out of restaurants, take the skills that they've learned in those restaurants and then do something different in their life. If they can stay in a field like beverage, that's amazing. But if you wanted to talk to somebody that wants to move on, what would you advise them to focus on? And what helped you make that transition from, 25 plus years into restaurants into what you're doing now and what you were doing when you left?
My departure from the restaurant business was 100% by my choice, was my doing. I decided that I hit a wall. I arrived at the end of the road in a sense that physically was taking a big toll on me. And also because I think that I wanted to distance myself from that universe where I was so comfortable and see what else do I love? What other passions I have in life that will speak to me now that I have empty space in my mind and in my heart to let that in? So what's going to present itself? So when I left, I took a good 6 to 8 months off. And it's so funny. People in restaurants, we create such a family, such a community. And a server, a jardinier, told me, Eugenio, you don't have to worry about it, right? I was like, what do you mean? He goes, everyone will want to work with you. I was like, I don't have that kind of confidence, but thank you very much. And I was fortunate enough that I received a few phone calls afterwards. And basically, I said to everyone that called me, if you still want to work with me 6 months from now, we will work together. But right now, I am in no conditions of doing anything. I needed to clear my head. So I traveled for 6 months. And it was almost a year before I assumed another position. And my first position was with my dear friends, Todd Gatula and Aaron Brooks, the owners of Ernest Vineyards in Sonoma Coast, because they always wanted to work with me, and because we were friends, and that was an easy transition. But then it came the other opportunities, and the teaching opportunities were also easy because I have this passion, I have this wish and this desire to pass on, to give to others what I've learned, what I've accumulated. And then when the job with Portugal came, that was a much bigger commitment that I had to really embrace a cause. But what, going back to, this is just a brief description of how I made these decisions in my life, but going back to your initial question is, what would you say to someone that wants to do that? You actually touched on a few of those points. Remember what you learned in the restaurant business. That is a priceless school. You don't get ratings, you get tips. But remember all the lessons you learned. Remember all the contacts you made. Remember all of those people that thanked you profusely and they are in other types of business. Ask for an interview. Oh, can I talk to you, David? I don't want a job with the Washington State. I want to just pick your brain. And I had many, many wonderful people that would sit down with me and just say, well, this is what's happening in the trade portion of it, on the export, on the import, on the distribution channels. This is what's happened. So I've gathered from other people what their lives were like. So I could just like filter and distill that into like, which one of these options will make me happy? Because it's not all about the money. It's not all about the title. It's about waking up every day and looking forward to what's on your calendar, not dreading it. That's the key. To me, number one was that I need to look at my calendar and be excited for what's in there for me for the day.
I always find that successful people, and I think this is where you're getting at, I want to know what's underneath it. Successful people, they always know why they're doing what they do. Whatever it is they're doing in their day, and they're balancing these million things, and they're trying to do too much, and they can't do enough and all that, right? But underneath that, I feel like they know why they're doing it. Why do you do what you do every day?
Because I love life. I love every day, every second of it. I am already regretting the fast approaching end of it, and I want to enjoy it every minute that I possibly can. A friend of mine said, why don't you retire? Asked me the last night, actually, over dinner. Why don't you retire? And I said, why would I stop? I would stop doing what I love and replace it with what, really? If I'm going to give up what I love, what would I do instead? What I don't like so much? It didn't make any sense. So I think that I really look forward to a life of adventure, to a life of connections. I really enjoy going to conferences like we did. And you, all of a sudden, you're opening your heart in a way that you didn't expect, like you are making me do today, or things that we didn't rehearse this. I had no idea what you're going to ask me. And these questions are stimulating to me. So I'm feeling really good about what the subject matter of the discussion or the subject matters. And I just think that motivation and enthusiasm, I have this enthusiasm for life that is unbreakable.
How do you practically approach that? Like, not to get in the nuts and bolts of it, but maybe that is what I'm asking, because you obviously have that deep well of love and enthusiasm for life done, but you also have a job to do and you have responsibilities to do. Are you the type of person who wakes up each day, or maybe you set this years ago intentionally, like, this is how I'm going to approach my day and my responsibilities. How rigid are you with that? And how do you set that up for yourself each day? Because you have to think ahead, right?
And say, you have to be.
Here's what I'm doing. How do you approach that?
I think you have, David, you probably know this too well as well. You have to be disciplined. There are tasks that have to be finished by the end of the week. You know what I hate the most? Writing reports, because I have to look back. And I have to go back to 3 months, 4 months, 5 months. And my mind is 5 months ahead, not behind me. The behind me is already accomplished, checked, done, move on. I try to be very disciplined. I am unfortunately a procrastinator, and I tend to do things at the last minute because I don't want that to drag for days or hours or months. But I do think that you have to, I usually do the things I like first. And then, let's say if I'm like a writer, you know, like you're having a writer's block or something like this. If I'm in the middle of a project and I can't get no inspiration from it, I drop it. I put on my tennis shoes, grab my bag, go play tennis or go swimming or go for a walk or go for a coffee. And then I come back to it, because you can't just, whatever you push these things out of you in terms of ideas and projects, it was forced and it didn't flow, it's not going to be good. So you have to be watchful for when you are doing something with a grudge, or when you are doing something with a big smile on your face and you can't type fast enough.
You've talked about tennis now a number of times, and I've talked about tennis before. I know tennis has been a huge, not just a hobby of yours, but something that's kind of kept you grounded, kept you focused and balanced. What is it about tennis, the game, and you've been playing for decades now? Like, how has that served you throughout your career? And like, what is it about the game that charges you up?
What an interesting question. I was a volleyball player most of my life, by the way, even in college. But my change to tennis came when I saw the detail. When I watch on TV, I would wake up at 3 a.m. to watch the French Open and watch until 7 a.m. and then take a nap and go to work, go play tennis and then go to work. When you were playing tennis, and I don't want to bore you with the speech about tennis, but there's one thing in your mind, something this size coming at you fast. So some people meditate, because when you're meditating, there are periods of the meditation where you let noise in and you acknowledge and you let temperature and you feel your environment. Tennis, you do not have the option of paying attention to anything else but that little thing coming at you, and you need to figure out what to do fast. So it is almost like it's hyper-focusing. So that took my mind out of everything. That's why I spent an hour and a half, 2 hours on the court hitting that ball. It seems silly, but one, I love it, so I was having pleasure. And two, it was the focus. Everything else faded away. And there was just that in front of me, coming at me fast. And I wanted to look as elegant as Roger Federer, of course. But now, tennis is a late in life passion. I started tennis when I started working at Jardiniere. There was a group of us that wanted to take lessons, and that was in 2003, I believe. And I was the only one that continued to this day. So almost 20 years on it. I didn't start early like most people do. I taught myself how to ski at age 33. I taught myself tennis as I said, in 2003. I'm not going to tell you how old I was. So these are self-taught disciplines or sports, because I did it with a passion. I loved them, and I had to figure that out. I need to know how to do this.
I love it. You've branched many different facets of the beverage world. We've talked about restaurants. You've created wine lists and worked with operators to create wine lists that, you know, the financials are important, you know, the business is important. You've traveled around the wine world extensively. You've worked in marketing, you've worked in education, importing. You've encountered and worked with so many different people in this business and so many high position players in this industry. What qualities did those people have in common? And what does someone need to be really successful in this industry? And I don't just mean a specific part of this industry, like the overall industry. Like, what are those qualities that someone needs to have?
That's a tough question again. I think one thing in common is vision. You have to see beyond. You have to have an opportunity to see beyond. And that didn't come to me very easily. I could not see my life beyond the restaurant world. When I was deep in it, I was so deep in it that I didn't think of like, okay, if this doesn't work, or when I'm tired of this, I'm going to do that. That was not that simple. But I think the most successful people I've met have passion and dedication. And a lot of them had the funds to finance their dreams. It is not a very easy industry, as we all know. And it takes a lot of headaches and heartaches to succeed. I think perseverance is very important. I have never had desire to make wine. And everybody asked me, don't you want to make your own wine? I was like, no. I like my wine to come to me in the bottle with a label on it, and I just have to open it. I'm very happy with that situation. But some people always been in the restaurant business and wanted to be, I want to open my own catering company. Others have I want to start an importing company. And a friend of mine, maybe a common friend of ours, told me one day, you should become the ambassador for the country of Portugal. And I was like, really? Why? And she goes, because you love it. And you come here all the time. And we're having this conversation in Portugal. That was my dear friend, Gillian Balance, Master Sommelier from Napa Valley. It was this conversation. And I was like, huh, that's an interesting thought. And that went away. And then that came around and I received an invitation. And she goes, remember when we had that conversation and you were like, why? Look, full circle. Yeah. So I think that going back to your original question, I think there has to be, which I lacked, vision and drive. I had the drive, but I never been like a go-getter, like I'm going to make friends with this guy because he's a banker and he's going to bank my next enterprise. And I never approach anything with a calculated mind, to my fault. Maybe I would have benefited from it if I have, but I'm happy the way things went. And it is, as you said, a difficult business. The wine business is very difficult. Not everyone succeeds. But I think that if you are hardworking, and I tell everybody, you said the restaurant is a great school. And I always say the restaurant's a great school. But I think you need to be very humble to succeed in this business, because it makes me think of a line from The Layer Cake that is 2X rated to repeat it here. But the more you progress in life, the less problems you will have, the less things get easier and easier and easier, because your vision becomes clearer and clearer and clearer. So I'm not a very good advocate to say, this is how you make $1 million a month. But this is how you go to bed happy with what you've done. I can talk about that.
But there's something instinctual about your approach to life where you're fully present. You're like, it's all on the table. It's all right there. And like that in itself stands out, right? Everyone has a different way. If you're not a cerebral person who wants to like detail this out in an Excel doc.
Yeah.
You know, you're showing up profoundly in person in the moment, which in itself stands out.
There's something that I read somewhere that I love that thought. I don't know who did it. I don't know if it is going to sound corny or not, but it said, be yourself. Everyone else is taken. This is what I got. So the options, I was born void of envy. I don't know what that feels like. I don't, somebody else's belongings, somebody else's fortunes or misfortunes are not mine. I've only have one ticket in this journey. So I try to make the best of it and pay very much attention to what I'm doing and how I treat everyone around me. You know, if you walk out of your house and your neighbors lock the door because they saw you coming, you know, you're not doing a good job. But if they pop a head out and kids come and see who's here, is Eugenio? And that's what I usually get. So I'm doing something correct. So
let's talk about the people in this business now that have a seat at the table, that have a voice in this industry. It's changed
dramatically.
How is it different today than when you started in the 1980s? And where are we now? And you are doing a great job helping shape this industry for a new future. Where do you want it to go? So where were we? Where are we today? And where do you want this industry to go in terms of being more welcoming to all voices?
I would love to see that the pursuit of excellence does not rely on the pursuit of titles. I have never been treated poorly in this industry. I think the subject matter alone, being wine, is very hedonistic. So people tend to be nicer in our industry. And I always say to people, they don't grow great wines in ugly places. So we are always going to be somewhere beautiful most of the time. I just think that the industry, what I would like to see it added to as a prerequisite is humility. I would like every professional, every young professional to be humble with what they do not know. I remember my interview process with Chef Tracy Desjardins for Jardiniere many years ago. She said to me, So what are you going to say when people say, well, you're not a master sommelier, you're not a master of wines. What makes you entitled to this job? What makes you qualified for this job? And I said to her, what qualifies me is because what I know really well. And what I don't know, I'm eager to learn. So if I would just ignored what I didn't know, that wouldn't fulfill, it wouldn't complete that picture. But I was humble enough. I was humble enough to carry boxes from and to a basement. I was humble enough to be stuck in a pile of boxes falling on me in the basement and remove myself from it without breaking wines. I was humble enough to wash and polish glasses on those many conferences that we participate. There's no job too small. There's a Portuguese poet that said, be great on everything that you do, no matter how small. And so be great. And I remember before I was in the wine business, I was working in a pizza parlor and I was feeling so humiliated at myself. No one was judging me. I was judging me. A college graduate and a world traveler, spoke four languages, and I'm working in a pizza parlor. What is wrong with me? And I always remember that thought, be great at everything you do, no matter how small. At Chardonnay, when there was a spill, I was probably the second person with a mop in my hand. And it's you just have to know that nothing is small. Nothing is beneath you. Everything is with you. I mean, we are all in the same level. So what I wish for the new generation is for them not to aim to the top so quickly that they will miss all the goodness in the middle and all the goodness in the bottom or the beginning of that journey. There's a lot to be learned every step of the way. Because if you jump up there, you just missed what it takes to be great. And you're just all of a sudden calling yourself great without any of that baggage. Right. That's dangerous.
That's awesome. We're going to switch gears. I've got some rapid fire questions for you.
Oh, Jesus.
So I'll ask the question. You give me the quick answer. How did you learn to swim?
I grew up in a small little town in Brazil that had the most beautiful rivers and clear, crystal clear waters and waterfalls. And we have a pool in our farm in Brazil, so I learned how to swim there.
What's the one thing that you cannot seem to get off of your to-do list?
Paperwork.
What's the very first thing you do when you wake up every day?
I complain about how much my back hurts, and boy, can I get that coffee quickly.
Wow, interesting. So everything you've said so far, the first thing you do is complain.
I tend to overdo physically speaking. I shouldn't do as much as I do. I have had many issues from the years of playing tennis and working on my feet. And I pay no attention to that. I just plow right through it
and
pay the price later.
Just abuse the body to get what you want to do.
Yes.
What makes you laugh every time?
Oh, my God. Children, babies. I'm like crazy about them. And I look at them and my smile just goes up to here. I love those big eyes looking at me and being so innocent and wanting to play. And I just, that makes me, I don't think laugh, but it smiles. It makes me smile broadly.
What's your go-to dish to make when you're entertaining at home?
I actually told at a party the other night that I cook several dishes and they all taste like chicken. I don't think I'm very versed in terms of techniques, but I can get creative. I love to cook. I make this killer Brazilian black bean stew that I like to make. I also make some regional dishes that are like paella-like. Type of rice things and risotto and things like that.
What's one thing you'll never do again?
Oh, brother. We're talking about like, that is a heavy one. One thing that I'll never do again. Have I done many things that I've regretted? Wow, David, that caught me off guard. I would never have another knee surgery. How about that? I've had four. So I had enough with that.
Oh man, and that's a long recovery process, right? Each time.
Yeah.
But you're still back out on the tennis court?
Like, I'm a miracle of nature.
Hitting hard after 40 surgeries?
Whenever I'm playing doubles, I tell my tennis partner, when you don't see me getting that ball, it's not because I'm lazy. It's because I really can't stop. I would probably have to keep going the length of the club because of my knees. It's not like run, Forrest, run, and he keeps running off the stadium.
Yeah, that 10-inch span above and below each knee, it's all just mechanics between there. Just
I'm bone on bone. And
wow.
Still working.
What's one thing you were really into as a kid?
I loved my farm. My dad had a farm in Brazil, and we've always spent vacations in our farm. I love the smell of the farm, the smell of the grass, the smell of the cows, the smell of the chickens and the fresh eggs and the milk and the sugar cane. And those are smells. I'm into smells. Thank God I have this profession. Mm-hmm. I can probably tell if a repair person came into my, let's say I had a building before, I would walk into the building and go, oh, there's a different perfume here. And then I would ask about, did somebody come in today? Oh, yeah, the guy came in to fix your pipes on the back. I mean, I have a very acute sense of smell and the smells of childhood memories. That's I'm very fond of that.
That's awesome. What's the last thing that you ordered on Amazon?
Masks. Just arrived today because I'm traveling overseas and I bought a stash of them.
When's the last time you used a Band-Aid?
2 days ago, I cut myself on the wine foil.
You still do that too? Does that never stop? Are we just cursed with like always being cut to the freaking
foil? Well, because we have old bottles, right? And old bottles of wine, they're precursors of this newer wave of wax and easier things. But
man, I cut myself on new bottles.
Got a little cut 2 days ago.
All right. What magazines do you subscribe to, if any?
I subscribe to the Somme Journal. I subscribe to Decanter, Tennis Magazine.
There you go.
The Tasting Panel.
Knee Surgery Monthly.
Specials, Knee Surgery Specials.
You're on the cover a couple times, but I don't subscribe.
Yeah.
All right. We're going to change gears again, my friend. Did you bring your pen and piece of paper?
Yes.
You're going to hate me because...
Oh, go ahead.
I am going to ask you to draw. Sorry.
Oh, terrible drawer.
All right. Well, let's see if I can make the drawing easy. All right. So what we're going to do is you're going to draw while explaining to us the wines of the Canary Islands while drawing.
Okay.
Let's have you draw you playing tennis while telling us about the wines of the Canary Islands. And you're going to have 45 seconds. This is the Somlight Drawing Challenge. Are you ready?
Yes, I'm ready. I've already started.
Are you cheating? You've already started.
Well, you saw me. I'm done here.
He's off to the races, man.
So the Canary Islands, I think they're very interesting because I love wines from volcanic places. And this is a volcano.
Oh.
And the vineyards. And these are the vineyards. And I think that volcanoes really inform lava and basalt, really inform the quality of the wines and characteristics of the wine. What was the other drawing?
You better start drawing you playing tennis because you've got 20 seconds left.
Oh, boy.
Oh, I appreciate the volcano drawing of the Canary Islands. That was quite good. And now he stopped telling us about the
I'm terrible. I love playing tennis. I'm an aggressive player. I hit really hard and I used to serve really well, but now my knees don't let me push up so much anymore. So,
all right. I love it. Thank you, sir. I want to see the drawings again, please. Could you hold them up?
They're terrible.
Okay. That's an active volcano. I'm nervous about those vines.
Well, you know, the Canary Islands, they had a big eruption recently and the little vines. Right on the foot of it.
Oh, those poor vines. Let's see the, can I see the tennis, please, again?
Oh, it's terrible.
Let's just see how terrible. Okay.
Pretty terrible. This is supposed to be the net.
Your knee?
This is the racket and the ball.
I'm worried about your back leg. It looks like your back leg is bent at the knee. And
no, but you need to be settled, and I'm about to unleash.
Okay. You're winding up.
Yeah.
I got it. All right. Last question. You know, you came out to Washington State for Road Trip, which is our trade program where we bring people out every year during harvest. I don't think you'd really been here before, at least not on the level that you were for that. What did you know? You've been all around the world. What did you take away from that experience? Like, what did you find was happening in Washington that you were surprised by or excited by?
Where do I begin? I'm a firm believer that you learn more being there than reading about it. I have heard about the West Washington and the East Washington. I have heard of very different terroir, different weather patterns. And then you get there and it's like, you were not kidding. And the dramatic difference between the wet coast and the dry interior, that was like shocking to my eyes. And also another thing that I remember to this day, how beautiful I thought the Walla Walla region was. It was so, I don't know, there was something about it. I don't know if it was the smell of the earth or the light of the sun that day. It was just one of those days that will never leave my memory in my heart because I thought it was beautiful. Not needless to say that I love the wines from there. But David, what I thought was really interesting is one of the things that I find the most exciting about wine. It's how a plot of vines right here, planted next to a plot of vines right here, have completely distinct characters. And to understand the subregions was really important to me, to feel the power of the tannins of the Red Mountain wines that, quite honestly, overwhelmed me. It really hit me. And I was like, wow, this is some massive things. And then you move into other areas like Walla Walla, for example, what I got, acidity and complexity and length and depth of flavor and depth of aromas. One to me was about structure. The other one was about aromatic and fruit profile. Then I enjoyed both. Yeah, I thought it was very specific. I love the garagiste movement that is happening underground in Washington. We went to a warehouse that is like the size of my apartment where this guy was making wine. And I love seeing the big operations and how tiny these small operations can be. I thought it was really exciting. And recently I told you at Taxoma, I discovered this producer of Riesling that I love. And it fascinates me that Washington can produce some of the biggest, most structured wines to the most delicate, bright, clean, refreshing wines and cider. I was blown away. One of the events we had, it was a cider producer luncheon. There was no wine. It was all cider. Changed me.
Love that. I mean, I think what some people don't realize is, you know, we have 1,000+ wineries here now, second largest producing state in the country. 90% of those wineries make less than 5,000 cases. So it is an industry, you know, primarily made up of small players, but, you know, without the large players that have put us on the map. So it is an interesting place to visit because that's where you kind of see both sides of everything, you know, both sides of everything.
I'm yet to see, it's funny because there are two cities in the world that are famous for their weather, Seattle and London. I have never seen a speck of rain on either, ever.
Oh, wow.
Every single time I arrive at both of these places, the sky's open and it's sunshine and blue skies.
Oh, yeah.
I have never seen.
Yeah, Seattle would be four times the size.
So was the weather. Oh, sorry. Yeah. That's a friend of mine actually jokes and says, no, we just don't want you Californians in here. So we tell you that it's always gray and rainy.
Again, yeah, two sides. That's what it is. Two sides of that coin for sure. Well, I just want to say thank you so much, Eugenio, for your time today. Thank you for all you do for this industry. You're an amazing voice. You're such a generous spirit. And it's always just such a pleasure to spend time with you. I learn from you. I admire everything you've done. And thank you for your time today.
Thank you for all those things and that you said about me. And right back at you, my friend. Man.
Thank you all for listening. Stay well, stay healthy. This has been Somm Light, and we look forward to catching you next time with some other favorite wine pros from around the country. Cheers, Eugenio. Thank you.
Cheers.